Hi, how are you? I'm Lee Goodman, and I was an articles editor for the Journal of Law and Politics in 1988 and 89, or maybe it was 89 and 90. I graduated from law school here in 1990. I also went to undergraduate school here, and it's a privilege to be here with you. And I take it that many of you are probably politically oriented and are interested in hearing a little bit about the intersection of law and politics out there in the real world. I know that you probably have some classes that teach law and politics. I'm sure you probably have some election law course here. It's a discrete area of the law, and I can tell you how I got involved in it, not because my career is all that important, but just because it might be helpful to you to hear about the footsteps that others have taken before you. I had spent a year between undergraduate and law school working for a political action committee in Washington, D.C. It was called the Fund for America's Future, and it was the political action committee for then Vice President George H.W. Bush. And in my work there, I got to know an attorney for the political action committee named Jan Behrend, and he was a partner at the firm of Wiley, Ryan, and Fielding. And so when I came back to law school, I was familiar with this field called election law just through Jan. And we also had, as employees at the Political Action Committee, a lot of restrictions placed on us on what we could and could not do from the Vice President's Political Action Committee. And that was also the year, 1987, that he started his presidential committee, George Bush for President, Inc. And we had to abide by very distinct and significant rules about what you could do as an employee of the PAC versus what you could do as an employee of the presidential committee due to federal election law restrictions. And so when I came to law school, I was familiar with this field, and I targeted Wiley, Ryan, and Fielding as a firm that I wanted to go to when I was in law school. And like many of you, I went through the interview process. Wiley, Ryan didn't take one else, and so I worked at another law firm my first year, and then the second year I worked at Wiley, Ryan, and Fielding, and then after law school, I went to work there, and I split my time about 50-50. About 50% of my time was in election law, and about 50% of my time was in litigation, and that was by my choice. And we did a fair amount of election law litigation as well, both administrative litigation at the Federal Election Commission, as well as the issues that are tangential to election law that come up in courts. And then we did a fair amount of constitutional litigation as well, challenging the application or implementation of various election laws and restrictions on First Amendment freedom in the federal courts. And that's how I got my introduction to the actual practice of election law, advising corporations, advising nonprofit groups, advising candidates, handling candidates and campaigns, investigations and administrative enforcement actions at the Federal Election Commission, and then litigating several issues. I can tell you, just to give you a flavor, I was a brand new lawyer in fall of 1990, and the first two cases I was put on with a more senior lawyer were consumer fraud actions brought against the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Because the National Republican Senatorial Committee wanted to harness fundraising through electronic funds transfer, which was fairly new in the late 80s and 1990. I think a lot of you are probably very comfortable paying your bills by electronic fund transfer now, but at the time it was fairly new. And the National Republican Senatorial Committee's fundraising shop had a creative idea that they would send people checks for $25, real checks. And when you endorsed it and you deposited the checks, your endorsement authorized that $25 to be transferred back to the National Republican Senatorial Committee to fund your first two monthly contributions of $12.50. And thereafter, you authorized your fund to continue donating to the National Republican Senatorial Committee at $12.50 a month until you chose to stop it. And two attorneys general, one from New Jersey, Robert Del Tufo, and one from Illinois, Neil Hartigan, both happened to be Democratic attorneys general, decided that the National Republican Senatorial Committee did not explain this authorization clearly enough in their solicitation materials, and that by seducing people into depositing these $25 checks, the National Republican Senatorial Committee had actually defrauded consumers. And so using their consumer fraud statutes, they sought injunctions against the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Those were the first two cases. Had nothing particularly to do with election law. The law we were dealing with was consumer protection statutes. But our defenses were motions to dismiss were that the consumer fraud statutes of those states did not apply to First Amendment activity. There's a lot of case law that says fundraising and solicitation for charitable organizations and political organizations is protected by the First Amendment. And that we argued that the consumer fraud statutes of New Jersey and Illinois did not apply to non-commercial communications and solicitation. And we won motions to dismiss in both of those cases. That was just my introduction. One of my early cases was defending a new congressman from New Hampshire. His name was Bill Zeliff. And Bill and Sidna Zeliff, it took probably 2 years of my early career. Bill and Sidna Zeliff had bought an inn in New Hampshire called the Christmas Farm Inn, and they owned it as a proprietorship. And at some point during their course of owning it, they were advised by an attorney to incorporate the Christmas Farm Inn for liability purposes. And they incorporated the Christmas Farm Inn as a subchapter S corporation. But the Christmas Farm Inn was Bill and Sidna Zeliff. There were no other shareholders. Well, Bill and Sidna, when Bill decided to run for Congress in 1992, Bill and Sidna used the Christmas Farm Inn offices, the copy machines, the vans that they shuttled people back and forth to airports in. And they had always used the Christmas Farm Inn offices as their personal offices. They were the alter ego of this little corporation. But the Federal Election Commission didn't see it that way. And Bill and Sidna had an enforcement action for probably the third rail in election law, which is the absolute prohibition on corporate contributions to federal campaigns. And the Christmas Farm Inn, even though it was a subchapter S corporation, was considered a corporation, and the use of its resources was considered a violation of federal election law. And so we defended Bill and Sidna for about 2 years, and we were not victorious in that case. We had to settle with the Federal Election Commission, and Bill had to admit to a violation of federal law. Bill went on to run much later for governor of New Hampshire, and the fact that he had violated federal election law was brought up in his campaigns by his opponents, and Bill lost in a primary for governor of New Hampshire, and now I think he and Sidna run the Christmas Farm and gone back to private life in New Hampshire. Those are the types of early cases I had as an attorney. For those of you who may be interested in practicing election law, I can tell you election law is a little bit of a misnomer because you do so much. I can tell you that just this weekend, I'm general counsel of the Republican Party of Virginia. And just this weekend, I was reviewing leases and a contract for charter bus services for the Republican Party of Virginia. And the question was a simple contractual question. The contract that the charter company gave us had a release of all liability of the charter company as well as the individual bus companies that might provide the service, and a complete indemnification clause that the Republican Party of Virginia would indemnify the charter company and the bus companies for any injury that may arise for trips to bring people into Virginia on Election Day. Well, there are two approaches. One is to renegotiate the contract. Of course, the party needs the bus services. And the other is to send the contract to our own insurance company to make sure that our insurance coverage covers that type of liability. And this isn't particularly exciting work, but I can tell you that political organizations are businesses. Now, some of them are very temporary businesses. They start up about 2 years before an election. They might run through $2 or $3 million, and then they close out, hopefully not in debt, although sometimes they end up in debt, and then you're dealing with debtor-creditor issues. And so you can run across the gamut of legal issues in that two-year period, and as you run through, well, if it's a gubernatorial election, we're doing Bob McDonald's election now, and that'll be probably $10, $12 million. But if it's a smaller congressional election, you may run through $2 or $3 million. And you will run through employment contracts. You'll run through whether interns you take in meet the definition of interns under the Fair Labor Standards Act. You'll deal with vendor contracts and terms. You'll deal with termination of employees. And in the political environment, confidentiality can be very important. You want to make sure you have strict confidentiality provisions. But then when you let somebody go, emotions being what they are, you have to find ways as the lawyer to let people down easily. Often that's a transition consulting contract on your way out the door. And so there are copyright issues. The Republican Party of Virginia regularly sends us mailers that they want to send out. They send us ads that they want to post on YouTube. Sometimes they have music in them. Music is a background, and we advise that you need to buy the rights to that song before you're allowed to play it. The party comes and says, well, we want to parody a Geico ad. You know, the ad with the stack of money with the eyes on top of it. They had an ad like that they wanted to post on YouTube, and we had to advise against it because, one, they might violate Geico's trademark in the images, as well as their copyright in the ad, and in addition, there was music that was played through the as background music to the ad, and they didn't have copyrights to that as well. And political organizations can be sued for copyright violation. So it runs the gamut. Let me talk to you a little bit about about the areas of election law that we figure that fits squarely into it, understanding that all these other business and transactional issues intersect on a daily basis in the field. But we deal regularly with the Federal Election Campaign Act. The Federal Election Campaign Act was originally enacted in 1972 with significant amendments post-Watergate in 1974 that imposed significant restrictions on how much money could be donated and the sources of that money in federal campaigns. Congress made a determination that people should be limited to donating no more than $1,000 per election to federal candidates, that corporations should be strictly prohibited from donating any in-kind resources or money to federal campaigns, and in the 74 amendments, there were also campaign expenditure limits, that campaigns could not spend above a certain amount of money. The idea was that money was corruptive in politics, that we wanted to avoid quid pro quo arrangements between donors and candidates once they were in office. That those 1974 amendments were challenged in a seminal case that you may have read called Buckley v. Valeo, 424 U.S. 1, 1976. And Buckley v. Valeo upheld the contribution limits to federal candidates because of they acknowledged that donating money in politics is a First Amendment right, but they said that the government had, under strict scrutiny, a compelling governmental interest to restrict contributions to candidates, and that was a prophylactic measure to prevent corruption in our political process. the Supreme Court struck as unconstitutional the expenditure limits on campaigns and said that does not protect against corruption. If you can raise a lot of money from a lot of people in $1,000 increments, you should be able to spend an unlimited amount. And there's no compelling governmental interest implicated by how much you then later spend. That is a direct and unjustified restriction on First Amendment freedoms. So we lived under the paradigm of Buckley v. Valeo from 1976 until about 2003. And in 2003, there were several calls for reform of the federal election laws. And Congress enacted Shays-Meehan, also known as McCain-Feingold, which imposed more severe restrictions on the ability of the political parties to raise money on corporations, to fund issue ads pre-election. Those are the ads that didn't say vote for Smith or vote against Johnson. Those were the ads that said, did you know that Johnson's voted in Congress to raise your taxes 136 times? Call Congressman Johnson and tell him to stop his high-taxing ways. And Congress shut down those types of ads because they said they nonetheless have an impact on the elections. And in a case that I was one of the many counsels on, the Supreme Court in McConnell v. Federal Election Commission in 2004 upheld much of McCain-Feingold. However, we've seen now several cuts in several successive cases since 2004, pulling back some of the breadth of McConnell v. FEC. And right now, pending before the Supreme Court, is a case called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. And it's not a question of what the court's going to do. The court is going to rule in favor of broadening First Amendment freedoms, and they're going to rule in favor of Citizens United, and the only question is how broadly will they go. McConnell v. FEC was a 5-4 decision with Justice O'Connor in the majority, and that upheld the law. Justice O'Connor is now off the court. Samuel Alito and Justice Roberts have now replaced Rehnquist and O'Connor, and now there is a solid 5-vote block in favor of the more libertarian view in campaign finance. The only question to a lot of people who watch this is how far will Chief Justice Roberts go? Chief Justice Roberts has preferred narrower opinions that might let a trickle of more money into the election system, while there are some others on the court who would probably allow a lot more corporate speech in politics. And that's the only question, is how broad will the block of five go in this new one? We do a lot of counseling of candidates, political party committees, corporations, and a major growth field has been in the world of nonprofits. 501c6 trade associations, 501c4 social welfare and advocacy organizations, and even 501c3 tax-exempt charitable and educational organizations all want to engage in the political process in some way. And so, in addition to knowing the Federal Election Campaign Act, you have to understand, and the regulations of the Federal Election Commission, you have to know the IRS restrictions on nonprofit organizations and what nonprofit organizations can and can't do. The Internal Revenue Code places different restrictions on the political activity of each of those organizations I just mentioned. And the principal reason is because when you donate money to a 501c3 organization, you get a tax deduction for the amount of your contribution. And Congress's paradigm is that tax deduction is actually accounts as money coming out of the federal fisc, and that's essentially a subsidy, a governmental subsidy to the charitable organization. And the decision has been made, and it can be debated, is that Congress does not want to subsidize propaganda and electioneering. So 501c3s, by virtue of receiving their money on a tax deduction basis, are not allowed to engage in any electioneering. 501c4 organizations, your contributions to 501c4 organizations are not tax deductible, nor are your contributions to 501c6s. In some cases, however, 501c6s charge dues to corporations because they're trade associations, and some corporations and businesses will take a business tax deduction. Those organizations have to carry on as their principal mission, carrying on some social welfare or trade association business. They are allowed to engage in a minimal amount. We usually calculate that as less than 49% of electioneering. They also can lobby. 501c3s cannot lobby. They can lobby for self-preservation. They can lobby for earmarks. They can lobby for money, other things that affect them, but they can't lobby for other issues. So we are regularly in the business of advising groups of people who come to us and say, here are our political objectives. We want to eliminate the death tax in America. We also want to support candidates who will say they will vote to abolish the death tax in America. And we want to be tax exempt. What can we do? And we help those groups of people devise a business plan, if you will, based around the Federal Election Campaign Act and the Internal Revenue Code to design the right organizations, or sometimes it's a constellation of organizations. So it's not uncommon for us to tell a group, well, you want to create three entities. You want to create a 501c4 to be sort of the parent organization. It's going to be your main organization. It's going to engage in all of your public advocacy and all of your lobbying. And it can do that well within federal law. You will probably want a subordinate 501c3 arm. And the 501c3 can raise money in tax deduction, in contributions that are tax deductible. And it can engage in educational study on your issue of the death tax. It has to be non-propagandic, but it can be your study and educational arm. It can have forums, for example, those types of things. Some donors really care about that tax deduction, and this will be an entity that allows you to capture those donations. And because you want to play in some politics, we advise you to create a political action committee that claims its tax exemption under Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code. And then there are different ways to structure the relationship between the 501c4 and the 527 PAC based on your business plans. The other area that we deal a lot in is government ethics and lobbying registration and disclosure. And we do this both at the federal level and the state level. Just last week, we were working with a government contractor out of California that sells a lot of its technology wares to various state governments. They had an issue. They wanted to hire a consultant slash lobbyist in the state of Florida to help them sell their wares to agencies of the state of Florida. Well, Florida, in Virginia, that's called B2G, business to government. In Virginia, that's not lobbying. You can hire a consultant to go in, open doors, knock on doors, introduce your product to various government procurement offices and various agency heads. In Florida, that has been specifically defined as lobbying. And that triggers a registration requirement, quarterly reports to the state of Florida, disclosing the lobbyist's income from the company. And it triggers a whole host of other restrictions as well, such as a express prohibition against paying contingency fees to lobbyists in order to get business from the state. We do, so those are probably the principal areas in addition to and I should tell you that we also do state work. So for example, in representing Bob McDonald this year, we don't refer at all to the Federal Election Campaign Act. That only applies to federal elections. In Virginia, we deal with the Virginia Campaign Disclosure Act. Now, Virginia is 180 degrees different from the federal law. Whereas the federal law says corporations can't give, you can only give, the law was increased to allow up to $2,400 per election. In Virginia, there is absolutely no contribution limit at all. If you're a multimillionaire, if you're George Soros, and you want to give Cree Deeds $1 million, you're allowed to do it. It just has to be disclosed to the public. Corporations can give unlimited amounts to candidates in Virginia. And so the campaign finance law in Virginia is very different. The other area that we get into, and this will transition because I know a lot of you may be interested in hearing a little bit about Deeds v. McDonnell in 2005, is the whole area of election administration. We do a lot of advice, and we do a fair amount of litigation in the area of election administration. So, for example, that deals with everything from voter registration to absentee voting rules, to the conduct of the polling places on Election Day, to the day after Election Day in Virginia. You move right into a canvass the next morning. The canvass is where the local electoral board will receive all the returns from all the local precincts and then go through them with a fine-tooth comb to ensure that the addition was accurate, that the voting tallies were accurate. And they certify their final results within 7 days of the election. And then in Virginia, the State Board of Elections will then comb all of those results to make sure they're 100% accurate. And then by November 24th, you have a certified winner. And then it goes into a recount if the election is awfully close. Last year, we represented McCain-Palin's committee in two pre-election litigations in Virginia. Now, the election turned out to be very clearly in favor of Barack Obama, but going into the election, you're never sure. And so, how the election is going to be administered is of critical importance to your campaign. It's almost like setting the strike zone in baseball or setting the height of the mound in baseball. And you want to be sure that there are fair rules. You want to make sure that there is integrity in the election, and you want to make sure that at the end of the day, once the election has been conducted and the votes have been counted, that the public has absolute confidence in the result. In fall of 2008, we ran into two principal problems that boiled up into legal action leading up to Election Day. And the first was the counting of overseas ballots. There's a federal law called the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Voting Act, also known as UOCAVA, and it applies to overseas uniformed citizens as well as any citizen of the United States who just may be abroad. And there are special provisions for allowing them to vote on a federal form back in their home states in the elections. Overseas citizens choose to vote on a special federal form called the federal write-in ballot, and it requires the signature and information from the voter as well as the signature of a witness. And if you look at the form in 2008, the signature lines were at the very bottom of the page. There was no space below the signature lines. Virginia law allows domestic, that is, absentee ballots submitted by people who live in Virginia with just the signature of the witness. You don't need the printed name or the address of the witness. Virginia law imposed a disparate rule, for those of you listening, equal protection, for overseas citizens. Virginia said that the witness has to both print his or her name and home address on that form. And there were over 8,000 UOCAVA ballots in Fairfax County alone, sent out from Fairfax County alone. And pursuant to this law, the Fairfax County Registrar was rejecting these overseas ballots because people did not print their name and address underneath the signature where there was no space to do so. Federal law did not require it. So the first thing we did was we considered going to court to raise an equal protection challenge. Instead, we went to the Attorney General's office. We got local delegate Bill Janis, who's a graduate of this law school, who represents Goochland, I think the western end of Henrico, to file to submit a Attorney General's opinion request to the Attorney General of Virginia, who was at that time Bob McDonnell. And he opined that federal law preempted state law in this area, and that the state registrar should count these ballots because federal law did not require that printing of the name and address. And so we got thousands of votes saved pre-election through that process. Then it turned out that several registrars in Virginia did not have their domestic, the not the federal write-in absentee ballot, but the Virginia absentee ballots printed in time. Federal guidance is that to give adequate turnaround time for overseas ballots, particularly for service people in theater, it requires typically at least 45 days for the ballot to go out, for the voter to have a chance to cast it and then mail it back in, and for U.S. military duffel bags to arrive and get distributed back to where they're supposed to go. And there were thousands of votes that went out within probably 30 days of the election because local registrars in Virginia had printing problems and did not get their ballots turned around quickly enough. And we went to court to challenge that. We got a preliminary injunction in the federal district court in Richmond to require all of these ballots to be sequestered and to be accounted for. And then the court sent the case to mediation. It's been mediated for a little over a year. McCain-Palin was dismissed from the case. The federal court held that there's no private right of action under UOCAVA. In the meantime, the U.S. Department of Justice intervened, and so the case is now United States of America versus Commonwealth of Virginia. And Judge Williams just issued an opinion last week, I think, finally resolving that case, ordering all the registrars of Virginia to go back and count any UOCAVA ballot from the 2008 election that was mailed out within 30 days of the election because it did not provide adequate time for turnaround. It's not going to change any election. I litigated the Goode v. Perriello recount here in Albemarle County. That election was decided by 727 votes. There were only 77 late arriving UOCAVA ballots in the 5th Congressional District, and so it won't change that election either. But Judge Williams decided that the proper remedy for disenfranchised voters was to re-enfranchise them and to count their ballots. The other litigation that we were involved in just pre-election in 2008 was about 2 to 3 weeks before the election, the NAACP brought an action. The NAACP's action was targeting the city of Richmond, the city of Norfolk, and the city of Virginia Beach. And their concern was that there were a disproportionate number of voting machines in certain precincts in those cities, and that the disproportionate number of machines in those precincts would cause longer lines and have the practical effect of disenfranchising people by deterring them from voting by having to stand in line longer than other people might at other precincts. Now, this was a case brought by the NAACP versus Governor Kaine and the State Elections Board. McCain-Palin was opposed to late poll openings, particularly if one side got to cherry pick which cities or precincts were going to stay open until 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And so we monitored to see if the case was going to resolve itself. It went into mediation. It did not resolve itself. It came back to court with a motion for preliminary injunction. That is, the NAACP had a motion for preliminary injunction to require these polls to be open late in just these three cities. We intervened as defendants and argued to dismiss the lawsuit. Our position was fundamentally that if you allow one side in an election or one group that has a predisposition to cherry pick in which areas there's going to be disparate, there are going to be disparate and different election rules, particularly if you're going to allow two or three additional hours in areas that tend to vote Democratic, or we could have done the same thing on our side, that tend to vote Republican, you're essentially allowing one side to get three extra innings in a baseball game where only they get to bat. They get to run up the tally in their preferred areas. And there were other arguments. I mean, state law had set a minimum number of machines per certain number of registered voters in the districts, and we argued that that was a ceiling, and therefore there was equality up to that ceiling. And ultimately, Judge Williams denied the motion for preliminary injunction, the election came and went. President Obama won resoundingly, and the NAACP then voluntarily dismissed their lawsuit. So we do a lot of that. The other area that we get involved in is post-election process. And I can remember being in Austin, Texas, on election day in 2000, volunteering at that time for a good friend of mine, Michael Toner, who was a 1986 graduate of the university, undergrad. At the time, I was a 1986 graduate as well. Michael was the editor of the University Journal, which was the alternative, the more conservative alternative paper to the Cavalier Daily at the time. And Michael and I had practiced law at Wiley-Ryan and Fielding, and Michael was general counsel to the Bush-Cheney campaign down in Austin, Texas. And I went down at Michael's invitation to handle the phone calls that come in that day. By the way, I might add, on Election Day 2000, we had late poll openings in Missouri. I don't think they were so much targeted at the Bush-Gore campaign, although certainly they had that effect. They were really targeted at John Ashcroft's campaign for Senate. And there were state judges in East St. Louis, Missouri, who kept polls open for several hours after the election, and there were thousands of votes cast after the closing hours in St. Louis. For this reason, several states have now adopted new laws about late poll openings. In Virginia, the law has been changed to require, in the event anyone obtains an injunction from a local judge to keep a poll open late, all those ballots from 7 p.m. forward have to be cast provisionally. That is, they are special ballots that get placed in green envelopes and they get segregated into a separate bin. And their disposition will be determined later at the canvas, and that's to protect. Once votes get put on machines, you can never take them back out. Even if you vote the optical scan ballots where you fill in the bubble, once they run through the tabulator, you can never pull those votes out. And so what Virginia adopted was a rule that required those ballots to be segregated so that if there is an appeal of a circuit court judge's opinion keeping polls open late, and later an appellate court or the Virginia Supreme Court holds that those polls should not have been held open late, you can disregard those ballots. If an appellate court rules, you know what, they were right, they had massive problems, you know, there was a state of emergency in Virginia Beach, there was a hurricane, whatever the issue may have been, then a higher court can rule, you know what, keeping those polls open late was an adequate measure to protect the fundamental right of the franchise, and therefore you open that box and you count all of those ballots. But it allows for a judicious approach to dealing with late poll openings. And so in 2000, we were there taking those calls, advising lawyers in Missouri what to do. And I don't know how old all of you all are, or how many of you can. Do you all remember the 2000 night election coverage? Well, you know, we had no greater information at Bush-Cheney headquarters in Austin, Texas than anybody else had. I think Karl Rove had felt he had maximized his vote in Florida. And it was a surreal experience, you know, with Florida being called for Gore, and then Florida coming off the boards, being called too close to call, then Florida being put in the Bush column. Everybody was happy. We all walked up State Street to the Capitol. It was raining. There were these huge jumbotrons outside. And we're standing in the rain. It's cold. And Candy Crowley comes on the jumbotron, as you all may recall, and says the vice president's motorcade has turned around. And there was going to be no concession in the presidential election. Nobody had any template for that. I think that since 2000, I think that I've been through a few recounts now, and I can tell you that my sense is that the public has far more tolerance now because of that experience for recounts. Recounts are not viewed as so much sour grapes or extreme election measures. I think the public wants to get it right, and I think we owe it to ourselves as a democracy to try to get it right. Now, getting it right is sometimes an art form and not a science. And so let me tell you a little bit about Deeds v. McDonald in 2005. On election night, Bob was up by most reports about 3,000 to 4,000 votes. And when it's that close, obviously, well, let me tell you something else about those reports you hear every election night. And I've seen it. I've seen it in every election, particularly as I've gotten more involved in this area of law. I worked for George Allen's campaign in 2006. Those election returns you see at election night, let me tell you how they come about. The state pays good citizens about $100 or $150 a day to serve as officers of election. And a disproportionate number of election officers are people who are retired, people who may not have another job, or people who have another day job. State Farm, for example, gives a few hundred employees every year to volunteer. But these people are not professional election administrators, okay? They have a day job selling insurance or something like that. My mother is 73 years old, and she's been an election officer in Danville, Virginia, for over 20 years. But those people have to get up at 5 a.m. in the morning to go open a poll up and get all the equipment set up, make sure the counters are set at zero, you know, get the poll books ready. And they work until the polls closed a little bit. The polls close at 7, but everybody who's in line at 7 gets to vote. And so usually the last voter will trickle through around, you know, between 7 and 7:30, typically. And then once they close the doors, they have been there. They've been up since 5 in the morning. And here it is. It's 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. And you know what they're doing? They're sitting down with little computer tapes that are printed off of either optical scan machines. Optical scan machines are the voting, are tabulators. That's the paper ballot that you fill in the bubble on. You know, like an SRA test you take in school. Those get run through a tabulator, and the tabulator then tabulates them all at the end of the day, and it prints off something that looks just like a cash register tape. And they're not much bigger than cash register tapes. Sometimes the ink is a little bit dry, and you know, they're not real clear. If you're voting on the touch screen machines, they also print off tapes. In some precincts, those touch screen machines are daisy chained. In other words, they all talk to each other, and there's a mothership or a mother machine, and the tally of all those machines comes off one machine. In some, they're not, and you have to push a tally sheet from each of maybe 5 machines and then add those up manually. Okay? So here we are, people have been up since 5 in the morning, and it's 8 o'clock at night, and now they're being asked to tally up the results, sometimes in multiple elections. And they all have to sit there and do it and look over the shoulders of each other, and they're manually, and then they have to log into a computer and either call it in to the electoral board, or sometimes they email that in through a system. And those tallies go directly to the State Board of Elections, to a central website, and the AP or the Washington Post are watching that centralized website, and that's why you're getting, with 68% of precincts reporting, you know, the difference is this and somebody's total is that. And then you'll see with 72%, and that's because they're constantly updating this as these results come in. I have never, ever seen the election night results that you see reported by the AP be accurate. They can be off by thousands of votes. And that's why, because people make mistakes. Because they're tired. It's 8 o'clock, 8:30 at night. They want to go home. I have seen people miss tapes, leave a tape out, forget to get a tape. I have seen precincts forget. You know, if you're elderly or handicapped, you're allowed to vote at the curb. You don't have to come into the precinct. They call that curbside voting. And throughout the period of a day, there may be, 20 absentee ballots that went out to a curb in paper. And here it is, 8:30 at night, and they forget about that bin of paper ballots over there. I have seen people log in the race for delegate in the race for lieutenant governor. I've seen people juxtapose the number in 2005 Deed's number was put in Bob's column, and Bob's number was put in Cree's column. And that's why we have a canvas at the end of every election. The local electoral boards meet. They're, by law, they're required to meet the next morning after the election. This is a public event. You ought to go sometime and just watch if you're interested in this. And they have up to 7 days to iron out any kinks or discrepancies in the numbers to make sure all ballots are accounted for. And then they certify their total results for the county at the end of that week. And if there are problems or that they that appear apparent in the election records, they will often call in the people who worked in that precinct on election day to explain and try to work it out. So on election night, Bob was up 3,000 to 4,000 votes, and you feel pretty good with a 3,000 to 4,000 vote margin. That would be very hard to overcome in a recount. But the next morning, as the canvases started meeting, Bob by about 10 or 11 a.m. the next morning, that election night tally with 98 or 99% reporting Bob up by 3,500, Bob's total had dropped to about 1,500 votes. And as the next day went on, Bob lost more votes and more votes as people found problems in their results. I can tell you we were very suspicious about this, why these changes were all breaking Democratic. But some of them were wholly justified. I mean, the Republican Party chair of Albemarle County called me and said Bob lost, I forget how much, but about 380 votes in one mistake found in the Ivy precinct just west of town here. Because Delegate Steve Landis had stood unopposed. And when they got to filling in the results, they put Steve Landis's number in for Bob's number. Just a transposition, put it in the wrong column. So when they found Bob and Cree's numbers, of course Bob dropped because that was an opposed race. It probably 50-50. And Steve Landis had gone unopposed and gotten all the votes in that precinct. Those were the types of problems. People found, 12 ballots that we sealed in an envelope. You know, most of these elections are decided by thousands and thousands of votes. So the fact that you stuffed 12 or 15 paper ballots in an envelope and forgot about them is inconsequential in most elections. But where the difference was three ended up being, Bob won the election by 323 votes out of over 1.9 million casts, which was 0.01%. And now, in some states, the state law is with a margin that close, and the laws will set a percentage change or a percentage threshold. In some states, the state automatically recounts. In some states, like you saw in Florida in 2000, it was locality by locality. Localities could choose to recount their votes given the difference between the candidates in each locality. That was one of the issues before the Supreme Court, if you recall, in Bush v. Gore, was that the recount was being conducted in a haphazard patchwork quilt fashion according to different standards in only a few localities, subjecting voters and their ballots post-election to disparate treatment, and seven justices of the Supreme Court said that's wrong. That violates due process and equal protection. In Virginia, we do not have any automatic recount procedure. The loser of the election must file a court action, and that's why the case was called Cree Deeds versus Robert McDonnell. And if it's a statewide election in the Circuit Court of Richmond, where there will be a three-judge court, the Chief Justice of the Virginia Supreme Court appoints two judges to sit with the Chief Judge of the Circuit Court of Richmond. Now, if you're in another election, for example, we did Virgil Good versus Thomas Perriello was filed here in the Circuit Court of Albemarle County, and the chief judge of this district from Louisa County, Timothy Sanner, sat, and Chief Justice Hassell appointed two judges to sit with Judge Sanner. But it is a litigation, And the principal issue you're going to litigate is the procedure by which the recounting will occur. And I can tell you, my honest opinion is that if you recounted according to different subjective standards and you recounted numerous times, you'd get a different result almost every time, depending on the subjectivity of the recounters and the procedure of the recounting. Every time you handle ballots, you risk smudging them, losing them, and so when you are the winner of a recount, you want fewer variables to enter into a recount. And when you're the loser, you just assume they reshuffle the whole deck and introduce as much human error as possible, because what you really want is a different count than the count that you have. And here was the issue. Every recount's a little different. There's a little different issue in every one. If you watch the Senator Coleman's recount, the Coleman v. Franken in Minnesota, the issue there was disparate treatment of absentee voters, that each locality had used different screening standards to allow absentee ballots into the count. In the Deeds v. McDonald case, the question was really this. Do we rerun about 500, I think it was about 540,000 out of 1.9 million ballots were cast on paper, that is the optical scan ballots where you fill in the bubble. Do we unpack them and rerun them all and then ask the machines to spit out or reject any undervote or overvote? An undervote is a ballot where the machine reads no vote at all in that election. An overvote is where the machine reads two votes in that election. People sometimes do that. They might vote for Deeds and McDonald. And it happens, and that's called an overvote. And by the way, by law, that means it's no vote. But you have the machine spit out those ballots that don't get counted either because of an undervote or an overvote in that election. And then you manually review all of those ballots to see if there are any marks on the ballot in that block for the election that would indicate the voter intent. Because the standard is, if the voter intended to vote, and here are the primary problems you get on the optical scan ballots. Some voters circle the bubble instead of filling in the bubble. And the tabulator uses an infrared reader that targets the bubble. And if it can't pick up the lead from the number two pencil in the bubble, it's going to reject, it's not going to find a vote. But under state law, if you were to look at that ballot and you saw that the circle had been circled, or they circled the name Deeds or McDonald instead of filling in the bubble, on a recount, if you manually review it and you see that, you can count that as a vote. And the State Board of Elections has issued a lot of standards that show you what counts and what doesn't count. So Cree and his lawyers wanted to rerun 540 optical scan ballots, having the machines reject those that showed undervotes or overvotes or undervotes, and then have those manually counted. We argued on behalf of Bob McDonald that that type of process in this close of an election, we had expert opinions to say this, would introduce as much human error as it would get you accuracy. Reshuffling, rehandling ballots, lost ballots, turning them into subjective judgments, the way you saw people holding up Chads in Florida, and that you would introduce as much human error and marginal error in the process of counting as you would get more accuracy. And the court ruled in our favor. And ruled that the statute in Virginia said that the presumptive procedure was to retally the votes according to the printouts from the machines that were printed out on election day, and if a tape was lost or not clear, only then would you rerun the ballots. So we got to about 4 days before a Tuesday recount. So mind you, at this point they're pulling out the election equipment. The people who are going to be officers of the recount are trained. They are they're being trained according to this procedural order from the court. And Cree's legal team on Friday afternoon before a Tuesday recount was to occur filed another motion. And they brought in data that said any undervote total of greater than 3% is statistically abnormal. Now, mind you, the undervote total in the election was 2.7%. We were a down ticket race. You're going to have ballot drop-off. It's pretty standard in most elections. And on the optical scan machines, the undervote total was only 1.7%. So there was nothing suspicious. The optical scan machines actually produced more votes and less undervote, what we call residual vote, than the touchscreen machines did. So we argued there was nothing facially wrong with optical scan ballots that were justify the court, you know, requiring this extraordinary procedure. The they brought in Kim Brace, a statistical data cruncher who worked on the Gore recount in Florida, and he's done several redistricting cases. And he said any recount, any unresidual vote total of greater than 3% was statistically abnormal in an election where the standard undervote was 2.7% in the Attorney General's race. And therefore, you should manually rerun and then count ballot that had from a precinct with a greater than 3% undervote. Well, mind you, we get this motion on a Friday afternoon. They don't give us their expert's report until Saturday night, about 9 p.m. And we had a telephonic hearing with the court on Friday afternoon where we opposed reopening the procedural order. The court ruled against us and said we're going to have a hearing on Monday afternoon. So we're in dire need now of an expert, a statistical expert. And we find an astronomer named... he's here at UVA. He teaches in the astronomy department here at UVA, and I'll think of his name in just a minute. And it turns out he uses statistics. He teaches statistics. He uses statistics to find galaxies in outer space. And he's not a political scientist, but the critical question is whether 3% in this group of data indicates any statistical break, any significant statistical break. So we don't need a political scientist. And so Steve Majewski is his name, or Majewski. And so Steve comes in, and Steve says there is no statistical break at 3%. And he can demonstrate why. And it turns out that their expert didn't derive the 3% number at all. When I cross-examined him in court, I said, so this report filed, this number that was filed on Friday afternoon was your work? He said, no. I said, whose work was it? He said, Mr. Young. Mr. Young was an attorney for Mr. Deeds. Now, I'm friends with Jack Young, but it turned out that the attorneys had derived the statistical method and the breakpoint based on where they thought enough votes could be found to cover 323 votes. And I said, so you were brought in just to clean up Mr. Young's work? And he said, yes. And then we brought in a real statistician who said there was no statistically significant break. Now, there was one thing that they came in with, and that was they came in with some tapes that showed uncounted ballots on the face of the tape. There were 9 precincts in Gloucester County, and there was 1 precinct in the city of Lynchburg, where the printout tapes themselves from the machines indicated there are 100 votes in this precinct that could not be tabulated. We didn't see tapes like that from other jurisdictions, which, you know, caused some suspicion about whether maybe machines in every jurisdiction can't read some of the ballots, but they don't have a line in the printout that tells you that. We conceded that where facial evidence like that in Gloucester County and the city of Lynchburg showed untabulated ballots, that you had to rerun the ballots in those races. There was one other problem, however, I want to tell you about rerunning the ballots, 540,000 of them. One of our experts, the man who invented the first touchscreen voting machine, He figured out that in about 135,000 cases, that is in about 40% of the 76 jurisdictions in Virginia that used optical scan equipment, state law said that in the case of a recount, you would program the tabulator to focus solely on the race you want to recount, and then reject the undervotes and overvotes solely in the Attorney General's race. In 40 of the 76 jurisdictions that used optical scan equipment in the 05 election, the machines could not be programmed to comply with state law. And what that meant was you'd either have to count about a little over 135,000 ballots solely by eye, manually. Or if you wanted to use the rejection mechanism of the machines would have to reject an overvote or an undervoted ballot in any of the elections, all the way from governor down to dog catcher. And so we were able to convince the court that was going to create a mess, and that would create disparate treatment of ballots post-election, a la Bush v. Gore. We ended up with a partial manual rerun and recount in nine precincts in Gloucester County and one in Lynchburg. Let me tell you what happened in Lynchburg and why there was a huge untabulated number of ballots there. The election officers had passed out pencils that were not number two pencils. And the infrared readers could not read the ballots in that precinct. And when you manually reviewed those optical scan ballots, you clearly saw the markings with, you know, in one box or the other for one candidate or the other. And in Gloucester, I don't know what the problem was, but they reran them, they manually counted, and both candidates gained some votes as a result of that process. Bob picked up marginally more. A little observation about that, where ballots do go uncounted. My experience is that when you do count uncounted ballots due to something like the Lynchburg problem, they tend to break the same way that the votes that did get counted in those precincts break. Bob had won Gloucester County. Bob should have won this precinct in Lynchburg. And so when those ballots did get tallied, Bob's margin went from 323 to 360. And the final certified result in that recount was Bob McDonald by 360 votes. Both candidates, Bob picked up about 90, close to 100 votes in that recount due to that. Curry picked up probably about 40 or 50, and the final result was Bob by 360. We are confident that had the court ordered the manual counting of 540,000 optical scan ballots, and had they rendered any uncounted ballots, that Bob McDonald still would have been the victor, and here's why. When you looked at those jurisdictions that had the optical scan technology, the voting machines, Bob McDonald carried those jurisdictions as a whole by about a little greater than 55 to 45%. And because of my experience in watching those ballots break about the same way the jurisdictions do as a whole, we were pretty confident that Bob would have won by even greater than 360 votes. I can't tell you how many. I don't know how many residual votes may have actually turned up in a manual recount. The Virginia General Assembly has subsequently changed the law, and now the presumptive procedure in a recount is to automatically rerun all of the optical scan ballots in a recount. That's the law of Virginia now. So in 2008, when we filed a court action called Virgil Goode versus Thomas Perriello to recount the 5th Congressional District's votes, they took all the fun out of the lawyering of it. no more experts needed. The presumptive procedure was to rerun them. And when they did that, Virgil picked up about, and I'm estimating, but Virgil picked up about extra 125 votes, 130 votes. And Tom Perriello picked up an additional about 90 to 100 votes. Virgil's difference, the net change, was that Virgil picked up about an additional 17 or 20 votes in the recount. But there were an additional 200 and some additional votes that were captured in the recount that did not get counted in the certified result of the state. And that's just in one congressional district. where the majority of machines were touch screens, not optical scan. So you can ballpark that, what that would mean in a statewide election. And the major issue that was litigated there, but in the end it didn't render a much of a difference, was whether or not we should count 77 late arriving UOCAVA ballots. And the court ruled 2-1 against counting those 77 ballots. Some of them now will be counted under the decision of Judge Williams, but they won't change the election between Congressman Good and Congressman Perriello. Well, I'm done. If you have any questions, I see we probably have about 5 minutes. Any questions? Okay. Yes, sir.
Do you have a comment on the voting of ballots in Florida prior to the election in 2000?
The purging of ballots?
No, not ballots, but registrations.
Keeping accurate registration rolls is has been a debate for many, many years. And you since you know about the issue, you probably know that the political debate is this. We need accurate, one side argues we need accurate registration rolls, and they should be updated regularly, because having more people on the registration rolls than actual voters in the district, and that's what happens when you don't occasionally update the registration rolls. Purge, some people consider to be a pejorative word. But what you do is you occasionally eliminate voters from the registration rolls, because records show that they have passed away. Records show that they have moved out of the district. In some jurisdictions, they actually use proxies for that. If you haven't voted in, say, 8 years or 5 years, then they eliminate you from the registration rolls. One side of the debate argues that that's necessary to keep accurate and up-to-date registration rolls, because if you have too many non-voters, people who've moved, passed away, on your registration rolls, that is an opportunity to vote dead voters, non-voters, and it's an opportunity for voter fraud. The other side of the debate is very concerned about what they call purging of voters from voter rolls, particularly on a proxy basis, such as failure to vote in 4 consecutive elections or some other indicator like that. Now, I'm not sure what Florida used, but my guess is it was something like that. And somewhere between those two polls, I think you can see the argument for both. We don't want to unnecessarily purge somebody just because they don't vote in 4 consecutive elections, nor do we want to have dead voters on a voter roll. And there are several commissions looking at voter registration. You know, every time we put an election under the microscope, we find another kink or problem in our electoral system that either A, disenfranchises people unnecessarily, or B, lends itself to fraud and abuse in the election system. And by the way, fraud and abuse can disenfranchise legitimate voters just as well as election rules can. So right now, voter registration is the most recent target of reform efforts, and there's a bipartisan commission that is getting started right now with lawyers from the Obama campaign and lawyers from the McCain campaign to look at options such as how do we register everybody. In Europe, you know, they register everybody at age 18. And so one option is, let's just register everybody at 18 in America. Get them all on the voter rolls. And not have voter registration to be a disenfranchising rule of election, where people want to decide that they get turned on to an election within 30 days of the election, but they're now prohibited because the election rolls closed 30 days. Why did we close the election rolls 30 days? Because the election officials needed some period of time to finalize the registration rolls to go out to the precincts for election day, so that only those people who we know and have some registration of can actually vote, so that you don't have people who aren't entitled to vote coming in and voting and skewing an election. So I can tell you that voter registration is an area that is in need of a lot of work. There are some people, I'm not one of them, but some people on the far right who I think like very strict registration rules. I happen to think that very strict registration rules disenfranchise many people unnecessarily, but that we do need to find a way to have some integrity check on those who do register. I would favor, personally, a universal registration system where everybody who's age 18 or above is automatically guaranteed to be registered. Now, there are myriad issues that flow from that. Do you need the privacy people, people concerned about privacy, say, well, if you're going to have a national registration database, you're going to impose on people's privacy. There are others who say, what do you do once people move? Because there are domicile requirements in the states. I mean, a traveling salesman can't come from Maryland and just choose to vote in Virginia. And so what do you do once you get somebody in the national database? You still have to place them from place to place. There's a big issue about college students and whether they should be able to register and vote in the place where they go to college. Virginia has a constitutional requirement of domicile. So there are myriad issues you'd have to deal with to improve our registration system. That's my comment. Yeah.
I think we're going to have to stop there.
Yeah.
Classes, sorry about that. Thank you. That was great.
Oh, I hope so.
I put together a plate for you. I'm not sure how well it's going to do.
Thank you so much.
But I put different sandwiches. I didn't know whether you wanted ham or turkey.
I'm all set. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I have to run to catch the class.